I'd like to talk about meditation itself tonight a little bit. That's okay. Talk about how meditation interfaces with all aspects of our life. The activity of meditating, like we just did for 45, 50 minutes, an hour, how that's interfaced with, interrelated with all aspects of our life. It's not separate from anything that we might do. Now, you just sat and quote-unquote meditated. So, what happens when we do that? One of the things that can happen is that there are certain places in your mind or your body where your attention or focus tends to divert or be drawn, or you might say default, when you're not in your natural state. Your natural state is open, clear, free, unencumbered, uninhibited, the natural being that we are. It's loving, accepting. Those are its qualities. So when we're not experiencing life that way, what's happening? Well, we tend to say something else, something other than those things that I just mentioned. So for some of us, when we sit down and we don't do anything else, we don't distract ourselves, we're not talking on the phone, we're not, you know, emailing, we're not texting, we're not doing anything else. What comes up is what needs to come up. And that's actually what's happening all the time, whether we're, you know, working or whatever. Whatever needs to come up, comes up. So let's say you sit down to meditate, and what comes up is a feeling. Like, for example, feeling of sadness or anger or fear. Okay? When that sadness or fear or anger or whatever it is, irritation, frustration, comes up, and the natural state or the natural being that you are is actually taking place, and it's the field, you might say, of your being, then that state that comes up is just dissolved into that openness. Yeah. The state that comes up, the fear, the sadness, the irritation, frustration, just to name a few of the things that can come up, it just dissolves. Now, when it doesn't do that, okay, what happens? Thoughts can arise about the feeling. A story can arise about the feeling. Judgment can arise about the feeling. Another feeling can arise about that feeling. It starts getting complicated, doesn't it? It starts getting complicated. It starts getting involved. It starts getting convoluted. It's not so simple anymore. And away you go for whatever period of time into that process of life, still life, it's all life, unfolding. Only this time now, it's more complicated. It might even be confusing. You might stop and go, you know, this doesn't feel very good. This is unsatisfactory. I don't like this. And if one's not careful, one doesn't want to keep looking at what's there. And that's the whole world of distraction. I don't want to face what's here, so I'm going to distract myself. Meditation is an art and a science of not distracting yourself from yourself. Okay? So everything that comes up, okay, is, in a way, yourself. And in order to awaken or to experience yourself as you truly are, to experience your natural freedom, your intrinsic freedom, you can't be defended against what's coming up. Or you can be until you're not. Okay, maybe defense needs to come up. Okay, just think about that for a minute. These states want to come up for whatever reason. And now they're going to be defended against. So what's going to happen? It's going to get complicated. It's going to get developed in a way that if you're not careful, you begin to identify with that process. I am angry. Or even further, I am an angry person. I'm a sad person. I'm an anxious person. All this happening is tendencies of mind that almost, well, probably everyone, not just almost, everyone has, are appearing in your personal experience. How about that? Nobody experienced anything here tonight that isn't shared by everybody. Now, what might be my particular default might not be yours. When I say your default, it's where do you most often, if we would do it statistically, tend to go when you're not free and easy in your being? Do you get pissed off? Do you get frustrated? Do you get annoyed? Do you get lonely? Do you get sad? Or happy? See, if I go there, does anybody have a problem with happiness? Has anyone here ever had too much happiness? Too much. Just overwhelmed with happiness. I can't take it. Please stop it. Yeah. Happiness, please stop. I can't take you. Generally, that doesn't happen, right? Or does it happen with joy? You can get too excited. People get too excited. Oh, and I'm getting imbalanced because they start to get sort of scared or distressed because they're getting too excited. But how many of us could say there have been times when you, in honest assessment of yourself, had to say, you know, I was really over the top with that anger. That was excessive for the situation, the moment. I overreacted. Or sometimes I overinvested in that situation. I overinvested in that relationship. I overinvested in that moment. I overinvested in that job. I overinvested in my meditation. I overinvested. You start to see these things really, really clearly. You see yourself relatively and not relatively. What does that mean? You see all of these things. Okay? And the less defended you are, the more you see. Now imagine you're not defended at all. And it doesn't have, defense doesn't come up anymore. You don't block anything. No more blockage. No more inhibition. Does that mean there would never be anger or fear or sadness? There's no guarantee on that one. But they wouldn't be turned into this complication that I tried to describe a few minutes ago. That actor, Alan Arkin, I like him sometimes in his roles. He said, you're either growing or you're decaying. There's no middle ground. Now he's talking about psychological, emotional growth. He's talking about creative growth. He's talking about probably what's necessary to be an actor. You're either growing or decaying, there's no middle ground. When you meditate, okay, what you realize is that your preferences don't matter. They don't matter. If you have a strong preference for something, it gets revealed. It gets revealed into the light of your being, or this field of awareness, as I sometimes describe it. And it doesn't matter. If my life was predicated on getting my preferences met, suddenly I realize, or not so suddenly maybe, that it doesn't matter. So what matters? Someone gave me a book for my birthday. It's a very expensive book. I haven't looked at the price. And you know how some people, when they buy you something expensive, if it's a book, they got to cut out the price. They go in there with the scissors and they just snip off so you don't get to know. What's that all about? Anyways. So, this book is called Wisdom. It's a very big hardback book. It's very, very attractive, artistically. On the back of the book, there's all these little pictures, these little face pictures of famous people. And on the front, there's a picture of a famous person, and his face fills the whole front of the book. Can you picture that? The head is bigger than our heads. It's very big. It's like when you have one of those super big television sets, the newscaster's head is bigger than real heads. It's a little bit of a perceptual distortion. Anyways, the head is, whose head is on the front of the book? Clint Eastwood. And you look at his face, or at least I do, and you can see everything there. You can see all the pores and the hairs, and look into his eyes. It's very interesting. Why Clint Eastwood? I haven't figured that out yet. One of the things you notice is that his teeth are together because he's ready to shoot you. Maybe. His teeth are together. It's live or die, you know, because he talks with his teeth together. See, we all look a little bit like everybody else. Maybe that's part of the point. The name of the book is Wisdom. And there's everybody gets a page to write something. And everybody gets their caption, their main bold statement. I mentioned Alan Arkins a moment ago. You're either growing or you're decaying. There's nothing in between. Obviously, this book was put together because the people that put it together felt this matters. Wisdom matters. If you go towards a Buddhist perspective, what matters is the cultivation of wisdom and the cultivation of compassion. And they seem like two different things until you realize they're actually much more similar than they are different. So we're really talking about a fundamental act of self-love that meditation can allow. At times, though, it doesn't feel very loving to really look at yourself because you realize that you're not very loving towards yourself sometimes. In fact, you're very unloving towards yourself sometimes. You can be critical, judgmental, disliking, preferential, chopping yourself up on the inside between what you like and what you don't like, dividing up your world inside here, sometimes trying to have certain experiences and not have other experiences. And if any of what I'm saying seems true to you, what happens is what I'm describing becomes more and more and more and more and more and more subtle until it's not there. Meaning what? The game that the mind plays of trying to be other than you truly are in any one given moment goes away for a second, for a minute, for longer. And when the game of trying to be other than you are goes away, what you are is yourself. Natural, free, all-inclusive. No experience is excluded. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read this book probably quite slowly because it's thick and there's a lot of people that they're representing their views on life, on wisdom. What's, I guess, most important to these people? I'm going to find out. Right now, I'm still contemplating, why did Clint Eastwood get on the front? Because there's some really interesting people's faces on the back, but they only got little spots like about that big. Why wasn't David Carradine's face on the front? He's no longer around as he was. What's that all about? So back to the simplicity of the meditation. When you begin to feel the powerful potential for wisdom and compassion to emerge right here in your living life experience through sitting, let's say, and you discover that you can relax into everything that's happening, that you can really relax into everything that's happening, and that these ideas that things change aren't just ideas, they're actually, it's the living truth. That you don't possess and own anything. That's not just an idea, it's the living truth. that sometimes you can get what you want, and a lot of times you don't get what you want. The people who you want to be with go away, sometimes for good, so to speak. Things that you want to have happen do or don't. Sometimes you feel this way in the morning when you wake up, sometimes you feel that way in the morning when you wake up. Some people get to have their dream job. I talked to a person today who has their dream job. And part of their work is in the world of acting, and so they were at the Tony Awards, and they performed at the Tony Awards, and they got to walk on the red carpet and stand next to Liza Minnelli. Did I say that right? Liza Minnelli, not McNally. Minnelli. And this was extremely important for this person. This was really, really big stuff. So I was once interested in how come we compare ourselves to others. Because I was noticing at that time in my life that I was doing a fair amount of comparing. And usually I was on the low end of the shtick. I wasn't coming out better than others. I was coming out worse. And I didn't know what to do with this other than I was struggling to hopefully not compare. So I talked to a particular teacher that I had at that time, and he said something very interesting to me that I really appreciated. In the human life, there are things called fetters. Fetters are places where life has gotten fixated. Anger could be a fetter for you or for me. Grief could be a fetter. Conceit could be a fetter. Rage could be a fetter. There's classic fetters if you look at Buddhist psychology, and they're somewhat similar and somewhat different to what I just said. So I said to this particular person, I talked to him with a little bit of detail about my own personal experience of comparison, because I was hurting. I felt a lot because of this, and it was just happening, and I didn't know what to do about it. Ever been there? And you can insert whatever you want into that place where I'm talking about comparison. Insert whatever you want. Something's happening. It's painful. It's difficult. You don't know what to do about it. You're struggling. That's where I was. So I said to him, I said, what about this comparison? This is what's happening. I described it as honestly and as detailed as I could. And he sort of just seemed to take it in. Because it's one thing for someone to hear what you say. It's another thing for them to seemingly understand what you're saying. You see, when somebody understands you, they take you in. They receive you as if they are feeling you with their heart. Do you know what I'm talking about? It's a little bit different than someone just hearing your words when they understand you. And when you feel understood by somebody, it's like medicine. Even if you're hurting like hell, to have another person really understand you, empathically attune with you, is medicinal. And your experience sometimes shifts right there. And you didn't really do anything except you expressed yourself as best you could, perhaps, honestly. And there was this connection that happened. It's alchemical, it's mysterious, it's beautiful, and people give this to one another all the time. So, my sense was when I said this about the comparison to this particular person, I felt he really took me in. And in fact, just saying it to him in the way that he seemed to take me in, already I felt better. But then he said some words that really put the icing on the cake. He said, comparison is one of the last fetters to go before you're free. Now, for me, those words at that time were really, really valuable because it put my experience into a different context. I felt understood, of course, I already mentioned that. I felt seen, I felt heard, I felt cared for, that was important. I felt not judged, that was helpful. But then those words, Those words were words of wisdom. And when we hear words of wisdom, even if we're really struggling, sometimes our experience just begins to change right there. We read words of wisdom, sometimes our experience begins to change right there. If this book is really good, I'll bring some things in from it. You might go out and buy this book. Any book whose sole title is a single word, wisdom, better be good. If you're going to grab a word like that, say wisdom. At least that's my opinion. Judgment? Is judgment an opinion? Are your beliefs based on comparison? Are your feelings based on comparison? Are your thoughts based on comparison? Guess what? Almost all your thoughts are comparative. And that's fine. It's not a problem. Unless you're invested in your thoughts as reality. Unless you're putting one thought against another thought. This thought is better. I like this thought more. You think the thinking mind cares about that? No, it just throws out the thoughts it throws out. It operates freely. It expresses itself at times uninhibited. Or as that same person said to me years later, when I was talking about my crazy mind and all my, you know, sort of thinking process, he said the mind has no pride. Mm-hmm. It'll do anything. Once again, words of wisdom. Like a pearl. Yes, of course, my mind definitely has no pride. I see that very clearly now. So the mindfulness, yeah, the awareness that we can practice when we're sitting, it's really, really good for the body. Not that that is the most important thing. It's really good for this frame. It really helps in terms of the way stress can build up inside this body. It's very good for it in all ways. But more important than that, it's very good for the mind. That's why the word meditation, sometimes in the Pali language, is also a synonym with bhavana. What does bhavana mean? The word bhavana means mental culture. Culturing the mind. You see, and the best and healthiest thing you can do for your mind is observe it. Observe your mind. Know your mind through observing your mind. Observe all of your mind. Want to know your whole mind. Want to inhabit your whole mind. Invite your whole mind to be part of your life, because it already is. Befriend it. That's an act of wisdom. That's an act of compassion. And then what happens, slow but sure, yes, this is sometimes the way it is, slow but sure, your mind becomes your friend. No matter what it's doing, it becomes your ally. And now you're not working on purifying your mind. Now you're not working on getting rid of anything. Things change in their own time. Now you're aligned, not just with the natural state or the natural nature, the field of being, which is accepting, loving, joyful, like I said before, but you're aligned with everything that might seem the opposite of that. And that's how you stay out of trouble. And that's how you take yourself out of the trouble that you feel you've been in. Now, on the practical side, it helps, as many of you know. And practice, it helps to cultivate this which I'm describing every single day. This is why people will at times make a commitment to meditate every day. No matter what's going on, meditate. Sit down, stop, be still, breathe, allow, open, settle. Those are just different words that can describe what happens. Those sessions, you might say, of meditation. They sequence into one another. They build into a continuity so that that awareness, that openness, starts to permeate out. It expands into all the other activities of your life. At a certain point, there's no differentiation. If you're sitting, you're walking, you're standing, you're interacting with people, you're eating, you're doing whatever, you're reading. There's awareness, and there's what's happening. There's awareness, there's what's happening, there's awareness, there's what's happening. And that's your life. That's actually always been that way. But now, it becomes very, very clear. If you can go into that clarity, if you can abide in that clarity and that openness and that acceptance without sitting meditation, then go straight away to that. Why hesitate for a second? Drop the discipline. Yeah. Drop the practice. Because ultimately practice is about full living. Not practice and then there's living. Full living. So this here that we do, this sitting, and I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm imagining I'll probably sit for the rest of my life because I like it. It's fun. I like it. It's interesting. I might stop. I don't know. I can't predict the future, but I see no reason to stop now. So I love it. I love sitting down and doing nothing. I love sitting down and just observing. And not only that, but there's different ways that people access the Dharma. Dharma, again, to keep it simple, is the truth of the way things really are. It's not what you've been taught about reality. It is reality before you were taught anything about it. And after you were taught anything about it, and during your teachings about reality, there is reality. That's the Dharma. And for some people, myself, I would say one of those people, the meditation was the portal. It was the window into the Dharma. And that's just how it happened for me. So let us talk a little bit, see where we're at. Any questions, comments, observations? Particularly perhaps related to meditation per se, or no, although not necessarily.
For me, when I sit down and meditate, my mind's going crazy. Mm-hmm. I can hardly even keep my eyes closed.
Yes. So you definitely have that condition called the mind has no pride. It's just... Yeah, I remember a time when I used to try to close my eyes for meditation and they were just going like this.
Exactly, yeah.
And it wasn't because I was having rapid eye movements and relaxing. It was because I was nuts. Okay, so let's be very practical because there's a way to respond to that. So the energy is there, there's feelings, there's thoughts, the nervous system's doing whatever it's doing. Now what? We need a counterpoint that's reliable. If you perhaps try to observe that, really just observe it and not interfere with it, you get caught in it. So what you do is you just don't fight it, don't resist it, if you can help that. And sometimes inside that, there's a bunch of resistance and fighting, there's struggle. Or there's struggle that's been built up over who knows how long. You see, because all of what we've been experiencing is, in a way, impressed in our being. That's like karma. It's all there. So you could be experiencing any number of things from any sort of point in time, present or past. So you go to a counterpoint, and this is the not just the Buddhist suggestion in Buddhist meditation, but this is pretty standard across the board for meditation. Find the breathing, wherever it's clearest in your body. See if you can connect to that. Don't try to stop this, because you try to stop this, it'll go, oh good, you're resisting me. Mm-hmm. I'll give you some more. Don't try to ignore it in the sense of distract yourself. Like, I'm not going to pay attention to this, because if you're not careful, you end up suppressing it. You need to let it come out, but yet have a counterpoint that's reliable. So for some people, with that kind of thing, it's like, ooh, they get the counterpoint for a couple seconds, and voo, they're back into this. A couple seconds, voo, they're back into this. Let's say you sit for the whole hour, and that's what's happening. Back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Your very interest, compassion, and wisdom that's behind your movement to your breathing 1,700 times. Won't happen that many times, but a bunch of times in an hour is the practice. Pretty soon there's a gap that opens. Pretty soon there's space around this mind that's doing this. You're just describing one way that the mind can behave. lots of thoughts or whatever that energy is there. And you study what happens when you make that commitment. And you see for yourself, does this free me up some? Because there could come a point where that's still going on and your resistance to it goes away. It's no problem at all. The good news there is that when your resistance goes away to anything, it almost always changes very quick. It's resistance to things that keeps those things coagulated, complicated, fixed. So for some people, I don't know, you can see how this goes, that's not going to do it. All right, so we got to get out the big guns then. Can't get to your breathing, or you do get to your breathing, but this is too strong, so you go to your butt. You're sitting on a cushion and you drop right down to your buttocks. That's a pretty definite sensation. Sink into that. Sit into your butt, fully sit into your butt. In sitting meditation, that's as far away as you can get from your head and still be in your body, if your legs are folded. And that sometimes is a counterpoint that will work. Remember, you're not resisting this or trying to not have this happen. On the other hand, I'm basically, in a loving way, saying, you cannot have me. You cannot have me. Awareness lets me know, you can't have me. Mental, emotional. You can't have me. You can have some of me, but you can't have all of me. Because if you have all of me, you're going to eat me up. How's this sound?
Good. Sounds right on point.
What's that?
Sounds right on point.
Good.
Yeah.
But it'll really be on point if you apply it and you see that it actually...
I sit down and I meditate just for a couple minutes every, you know, in the morning and the evening.
Uh-huh.
And it's the same thing. My mind's just constantly going through thoughts, and I do, you know, bring it back to the breathing and count my breaths or whatever, focus on, you know, all the different little things, and it's just back and forth constantly.
It's back and forth. Okay, well, you're smiling about that. Okay, it's just already you're getting a little space, or you wouldn't be smiling about it. That mind can make people cry sometimes, or just be angry or frustrated. And I'm not getting anywhere. This isn't working, and then they even stop meditating. If you're smiling about it, okay, it goes back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. You might go to the butt if you've already been doing this thing with the breathing.
Mm-hmm.
Try it.
To me, that experience, however, is the first and maybe one of the most important insights in meditation is that you're nuts.
I'm nuts.
Right? And that you really don't necessarily have a lot of control over what goes on up there.
No.
Okay, it just happens.
Right. Right. And then the hopefully comical response, I'm nuts, is a breath of fresh air. Okay, I'm gonna admit it. Okay, I'm not gonna hide. And I'm not going to avoid, and I'm not going to try to distract. I'm not going to lie to myself. I really do feel nutty. See, the difference between somebody who can do that and smile and somebody who is nuts is that the person who is nuts does not know that they're nuts, either because they haven't admitted it yet or they're so in it that they can't differentiate themselves. They're people who are psychotic, and they think that what they're experiencing is absolutely real. They believe it 100%, even when they have somebody telling them something different. They get agitated, they don't like that, they avoid it. No, you're wrong, they get angry. That's nuts. To admit that there's a place inside that feels nutty is sane. But if we want to untie those knots, we need to have, in a way, a strategic, committed approach. So you've already got the counterpoint of the breathing. But what I would say is if you sit for a couple minutes, bang it up, you know? Bang it up to at least 5 a day. Bang it up to 10. At some point, you might sit for a whole hour like we do here on your own. Establish the right to be free from your crazy mind. It might not like it, it might fight with you. It might kick up, as one of my teachers said, a kick from within, it might get stronger. Your mind starts to get quiet and settled, maybe get afraid. We don't know what's going to happen. But whatever happens, okay, it's both unique for you, and it's also in the slipstream of collective consciousness of human beings, which means you're not alone. In fact, I know this guy on my left over here is at least as not an issue at times. Well, I could say that about myself, too. Anything else?
No, that's it.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for bringing that out. This is no different than meditation with the eyes closed. Just sitting, observing. If something comes up that wants to be spoken, it can come out.
The benefit of keeping the body still.
It's a very good thing to learn to do. I may have mentioned this here before, but years ago when we used to do the retreats at Vision Farms down in Micanopy, it's a residential center about 25 minutes south of Gainesville. Beautiful pastoral piece of land, 40 acres, and we'd have retreats down there. Different lengths, weekends, sometimes 5 days even. I think we did a 7-day retreat once. There was a fellow that came, used to come up from Tampa, he'd come to every retreat. And it's always fascinating when you're drawn to something and you keep going back. Something's going on there, you keep going back. Well, he kept coming back, I didn't know exactly why. We talked some. Eventually he told me why he kept coming. And so he said, okay, the reason why I kept coming is I looked at you. Point his finger like that. He said, I looked at you. He said, I saw you could sit still. I want to be able to do that. I said, can you do it? He said, not yet. So I said, well, I guess you have to keep coming then. It was kind of funny. But why do you want to sit still? Well, it's a skill. It's a skill to be able to sit still, just as it's a skill to move. You watch people who can move well, like dancers, that's a skill. They develop that skill. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful skill to be able to sit still. Now, what comes out of that stillness is immense. Your whole life comes out of that stillness. And is expressed as stillness and movement. Just to name one of the multiplicity of polarities that make up life, this stillness and this movement. Okay? So the stillness allows you to really observe more clearly once you can relax into it. Very important. Anybody who's sitting around, as I was for too many years, I can say that now in hindsight, trying to sit still. You know, you're resisting your experience. You're trying to sit still. No, that's not how it works. Relax into the stillness. You can find everything is relaxed except the index fingers. And when I say relaxed, I don't mean the whole thing is smooth and tingly. I mean there's no resistance to what's happening here. And this is just unfolding. In some places it's tight, in some places it's loose. That can be encountered, or it can be, you could say, open to in the context of stillness. Now that's very handy, because the stillness and the silence are actually one and the same, although they're two different words. Stillness is silent. Silence is still. Is it not? So what's happening is you're dropping, actually, when you drop into that stillness and that silence, you're dropping actually into the nature of what you truly are. You're dropping into your natural state or your natural being. because your natural being is still and silent. Now, that's the easy part in one sense. The hard part is that when you're still, what happens is it allows things to come much more to the surface. And so that's why people often move, because stuff is coming up, and it's in the knee, it's in the back, it's in the head, wherever it is, and so they move, they make an adjustment. Why are they making an adjustment? Because it's uncomfortable. Hardly anybody's moving because they're all comfortable. They're moving because they're uncomfortable. So what happens is you learn to allow whatever's coming through, even if it's uncomfortable. You allow it to come through without reaction. And what happens is you actually penetrate deeper into the fact that everything's changing. And that you don't have to do anything about it. Even your most fundamental default, let's say it's anger. You can handle everything else, but anger gets you. You can handle everything else, but grief, aloneness, loneliness gets you. You can learn to see that and let it come right through. It's very powerful. And a lot more could be said about it, but does that help some?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
What about walking meditation? Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, sometimes I feel like I lose all the blood flow and my
That's
toes.
Fine. That's fine. It works better afterwards. I used to have a thing where this whole thing would like feel like it was paralyzed.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Like the whole thing would go to here. And then when it got to here, the whole pelvis would start to go paralytic, it seemed. And then fear used to come. Because I would my mind would start projecting that it was going to spread, you see? Because I was more identified with this part of the body than I was with the lower part. I could let all this kind of go, but as it started to seem like it was spreading, this became quite threatening, right? And so then the reaction would come up and I would want to move and change it, you see? Now what you don't want to do if this thing goes a little numb, okay, or pins and needly, and it's time to walk, you know, let it adjust slowly. Don't hop up. Okay, it's not ready to function. So you just go like that. People say, "Well, I'm ruining my legs." There was this one monk, American guy, in fact, used to come around. Abhante Vimalaramsi. Some of you might remember this Abhante. The guy was sitting in Burma. See you later. This guy was sitting in Burma for like 4, 5, 6 hours at a stretch. He got varicose veins. They were pretty large. He didn't care. I think that's potentially a little extreme, personally. I mean, the point, I don't think, is to sit long enough so you get varicose veins. But in certain styles of Vipassana in Burma, they don't care if you die meditating. You can die on the cushion, it's okay. It's all right, it's a good death. He died meditating. He was in samadhi and he died. Great. He fell over, that's the end. So in a way, it could be disassociative and unloving towards the body in a way that might not feel comfortable to you or me. It might be extreme. Where's the middle path? Well, first you realize no damage is being done. How do you prove that to yourself? Because no matter what sensation is coming up, as long as you're not forcing the meditation, that sensation will change. And as you take your leg out of that position at the end of the sitting, just observe what happens to it. You'll feel the enlivening. You'll feel that the places where it might have even been knotted up and tight, all of a sudden the blood is freer, the nervous impulse is freer, your legs work better. And then you trust that it's okay to sit and let the tensions that are in the body come out. I learned this in a way at a time when I simply thought this whole thing was too much for me. I should just do stretching exercises. This Vipassana was just too much. It was too painful, it was too hard. And I felt all the fears that some people fear, that I was damaging my nervous system permanently, or at least my sits bones or my sciatic nerve was being ruined while I was sitting on my butt for an hour. That's fear. So the flip side of that is you begin to discover, you just actually experience what it's like to sit through what's emerging. And then you get up and you move and you see how that feels. Which takes us to the walking meditation. The walking meditation is one of the most beautiful complements to sitting meditation. And you learn to discover that mindfulness in the movement and the simple attention to the sensations. Now the primary object can be the sensations in your legs and feet, as opposed to the sensations of breathing, or as I was mentioning to him, the sensations in the butt as a primary returning point. You see, this is meditation that's based on getting enough collectedness and centeredness so you don't have a primary object anymore. Freedom from a primary object like breathing or sensations in the leg emerges when choiceless awareness is realized. Choiceless awareness is when there's no restriction and resistance on any experience, and then everything can just move. There's nothing to return to, and there's nothing to get, there's no place to go. Life is just unfolding spontaneously and naturally as it is. To use one set of words, it's called choiceless awareness. But walking meditation is extremely handy, as is standing meditation. Standing meditation will remove the need that the mind might have to wait in lines, or not like waiting in lines. Because whenever there's a line appears that you need to be in to wait for your ticket or whatever, standing meditation is available. Other people are doing this. And then sometimes it gets more than that. Is anyone else here? I watched this at a car terminal in San Francisco. It was like two people in the line in front of me. There was one agent, and the guy second in line couldn't take it. Are there any other agents here? He starts out like that. And the agent said, no, I'm the only one working. He said, I can't believe that. 7 o'clock. You're open 24 hours. He starts getting agitated. He's obviously not doing standing meditation. Some people feel they have the right to take it out on the salesperson. You're getting my money? I get you. It's different kinds of agendas. But the walking meditation, you know, you learn to really feel the walking. Just like when Thich Nhat Hanh said, when washing the dishes, wash the dishes. That's like standing meditation, sitting meditation. You feel that the most important thing you could ever be doing is what you're actually doing. It's so incredible. The most important thing you could ever be doing in a given moment is what you're actually doing in that moment. Because guess what? You can't be doing anything other than what you're doing in that given moment. In that given moment. The next moment it could be different. That's how intimate it gets. Drop right into the preciousness of the moment. So that can come through walking. I used to love the walking meditation myself. I liked it more than sitting. Because it was just so cool to just, that Tai Chi of the walking meditation, just to feel that. And then you go and you sit after walking like that, and your sitting just gets so fed by that. And then you get up and you walk after sitting, and the walking gets fed by the sitting. And this is what happens in retreats, and it's a time-honored tradition to go back and forth between that walking and sitting. So they're both great forms. But the Buddha taught mindfulness, fullness of attention, in four postures: sitting, walking, standing, and then the fourth, lying down, which is actually the hardest, to really be mindful lying down, because there's a tendency to drift off and to go sleepy, because that's what we've been doing since we were little, is lying down to sleep.
Question, I guess. Sometime recently somebody said they heard, I think a teacher from the East, I don't really know who it was, somebody saying that they don't teach cross-legged or floor sitting in the West because that's not what we do. We sit on chairs. And that the only reason it was sitting cross-legged on the floor in the East was because that's what people did. Do you feel like there's an advantage energetically or some groundingly to sit cross-legged or like this?
Well, if you look at, for example, the development of meditation through the yogas, particularly through the styles and practices and traditions and lineages of Hatha yoga, the physical yogas, those culminate in the ability to sit and to concentrate and to see reality. Or to be reality. Now that's a classic sort of progressive path. The asanas, the pranayamas, these things are intended to bring you to a place where you can truly sit and realize the power of the sitting. The idea that, you know, our Western bodies aren't really designed to be on the floor, I think is a little bit off in one sense, although historically people in the East have been sitting on the floor or ground more than us. I mean, we got chairs, right? But I find personally sitting on the floor to be very, very connecting. And I do like to sit in the chair sometimes, but I don't like it as much. I like to feel the earth. I like to feel and be on the earth. They had chairs in the Buddhist time. They had different kinds of furniture. It's pretty nice stuff, I hear. You know, plushy this and that's. You know, they had stuff. But sitting on the floor, if the legs can get with it, you know, and a big change sometimes happens in the hips and the knees and all the way down the legs. It takes a while for some people for the legs to really open up. But once they open up, then they hardly ever hurt. Or if they do hurt, it doesn't last. They actually get opened and they're not restricted. Now eventually that goes into the whole body. Doesn't mean there's never any pain, but just like if you got a perfect massage and you got everything relaxed, well, what happens is the meditation goes way deeper than that. Meditation goes deeper than any body work. There's no body work that can go as deep as meditation, in my experience. Doesn't mean body work isn't great. It's great. It can be nice and complementary. Now, having said that, if a person finds their particular body is, you know, much of their meditation is taken up with their hips are killing them, their knees are killing them. Some teachers will tell you, just sit through it. I was told that. Just sit through it. Like, I was a little bit like that Burma style. Just sit through it. You know? All right, I said. And it actually worked. You weren't allowed to sit in chairs. They didn't allow it in my initial training. They just didn't, there were no chairs. You couldn't lie down. You couldn't sit in a chair. There was no walking meditation. You just sit on your butt all day. It was kind of hard. But it was okay too. It really worked for me personally. Sitting in a chair is fine. The important thing is to have the spine erect. Because this is the part that we really, if we're going to talk about it from the bodily point of view, we need to get connected to these energy centers in a way. We need to get connected to the plexi. We need to get connected to the centrality of the body. These are the appendages. Okay, in Thailand they have kinds of vipassana where you sit with your hands like this. I have no idea why. You just sit there with your hands like this, or your hands like this. Or they just have the person sit there all day and go like this with their arm and feel this. There's all kinds of vipassanas. In Burma there's like 40 different powerful lineages of vipassana, all specifically, supposedly, rooted back to the Buddha. And all that means is it's a stylization of practice. Certain way in which the teachings are being stylized based on the personalities and the proclivities and the experimentation of those who make up the lineage. When the lineage or the expression is very authentic, then there's an immediacy that comes through. There's an immediacy of the power and accuracy and truth of what is being practiced and said, and people feel this when they do the technique in that lineage. They feel it. They feel it powerfully. Sitting on the floor or the ground, right, has a lot of lineage or tradition behind it. And ultimately, I think it transcends, you know, culture. It transcends hemisphere. So I actually, you know, because we have a funny thing about pain in a way, in the West, I think more than in certain parts of the East, we have a funny thing about pain. We really, like, don't understand it. You know, we don't, like, appreciate suffering. We try to not have it. Parts of our culture, at least. Yeah. But that's changing, because when Clint Eastwood's face, that Hollywood representative, is on the front of that book, and the name of the book is Wisdom. I'm just kidding. If you can sit on the floor, it might be the preferred way to go. If a bench is your style, because some people can't sit cross-legged. A fellow I mentioned last week who did 9 3-month retreats and was going into his 10th, he couldn't sit cross-legged. His body wouldn't do it. It was terrible. So he sat on a bench. What do you find for him?
A 3-month retreat is nothing but meditating.
Yeah. It's like what we did for an hour for 3 months.
I've been thinking about that all week, and it just seems amazing.
It's pretty amazing. Yeah, it was interesting.
How often do you get up?
Well, you do sitting and walking meditation, and
you're always meditating.
You always meditate. Well, meditation takes over. In my case, sleep almost went away completely. It was cool. It was just full awareness all the time.
So that guy's been meditating for about almost 2 years.
That's right. Good math there, Mark. Yeah.
Any disadvantages or advantages of meditating in nature?
It's beautiful. I mean, this Thai tradition I was mentioning where they have you going like this, they will meditate outside the whole time with the mosquitoes. Get okay with that? I mean, you might do a little of this, but also if you're practicing the precept of not killing, you're not doing that. It's got to go like that. You got to say, try not to disturb. It's different. Try it sometime. Next time a mosquito's sucking on your skin and your blood, that's what they want. That's where the juice is. Just go like this. See what they do. It's an interesting experiment. But yeah, sitting outside can be beautiful and nice, you know, if that's your inclination. I mean, these meditation centers in the West are mostly indoors. Occasionally people sit outside. It's a different kind of experience. I like it myself. I don't particularly spend a lot of time, you know, with mosquito meditation, because they can take over. You know, one mosquito bite is enough to bring, when you're sensitive, it can bring so much sensation, and the mind just, like, all this stuff comes out. One bite. Not really any better one place or the other. The point is to practice. But you're inside, outside. And then after a while, you don't have to go away from any of the activities of life, like so-called sounds, meditation centers, you know, are sort of viewed as places of silence and quiet, not talking. But a lot of these monasteries, at least in the East, they're set in big cities like Bangkok or Rangoon. They're incredibly noisy. All kinds of stuff going on. Even inside the monastery, all kinds of stuff going on while people meditating, because it's integrated with life. It's not about escapism at all. I have a spot inside, wherever I've lived since I've been doing this. I always have a spot where I put my cushion. I mentioned this before. I have a spot. In the house I'm in now, I had that spot since we moved into the house. Pretty much, not quite, but almost. Same spot. It's good to have that. It's good to have the same spot. It's good to have the same time if you can, but you don't have to, as long as you are consistent.
That's where my spot is.
What? Right here, yeah. But don't be uptight if there's someone sitting in your spot. Because sometimes somebody will be drawn to your spot and sit in it.
That's okay.
And that's an act of compassion. Okay. To give it up. Give up your spot. Okay. On Saturday, we have the one day. If you don't know about that, it's going to be from 9 to 5. Down at this lovely facility in Micanopy. It's a potluck lunch, which is what we always do when we use this place. There'll be sitting, walking, standing meditation. There'll be some instructions. Myself and hopefully Steve Bean, another teacher, will give some instructions. If I have my way, Steve would also guide us in some movement, guided movement, mindful movement, like we call it yoga. And we'll have from 9 to 5. And if you'd like to come to that, feel free to sign up. And how are we doing that on the directions, Ibi, for new people? What's going on there?
We have some on the counter in the kitchen.
Great. Okay, so there's a sign-up sheet. There's a sign-up sheet there, and also directions if you'd like to come. Thank you. This is Alana. Please feel free to say hi to her before we part tonight. She's with us for the summer, in between her semesters and years of college.
Hooray.
Okay. Good night, everybody.
Thank you. Thank you.